This is KMXT's Talk of the Rock. You're with your host, Kayla DeRoche, and a couple of people who know a lot about bears. Could you guys introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Will Dacey. I'm a graduate or an ex-graduate student from University of Montana.
William Laycock, wildlife biologist at Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge.
Okay. So could you guys talk a little bit about the project that you've been working on? I understand that you've been working on a project with the University of Montana. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I volunteered here for Bill in 2010, and in that year we documented a pretty large decline in bear density in the Karlik Basin. And so I started a graduate project with University of Montana and Flathead Lake Biological Station, which is also in Montana, to try to figure out exactly why that decline had occurred.
Okay. So before we begin and really dig into that project, can we talk a little bit just about bears in general to give an idea of what kind of bear populates this island in particular, the Kodiak bear? So first of all, could you tell me a little bit about how the Kodiak bear differs from some of the other species out there?
Okay, Kodiak brown bear is generally considered a separate subspecies, okay, and that's largely because of its isolation being on an island. And they probably colonized the Kodiak archipelago 10 to 12,000 years ago during the retreat of the last glacial period, and have been isolated pretty much since then. So that warrants a subspecies designation in many people's view, and it's among the largest bears in the world. Okay, all coastal brown bears are relatively large. So over on Katmai on the peninsula, they're quite large. Here, they're quite large. In Kamchatka, they're quite large, and that's largely due to abundant food resources, we believe, and in accessibility of salmon.
Okay, and so when you say large, how much weight are we talking about?
Okay, they can get really large. You know, you have some specimens that are quite large that may be up to 1,500 pounds, but more commonly, for example, the bears that we've handled have been largely females, and they've averaged about 470 pounds in the end of May, beginning of June. Of course, they'll be a lot heavier than that, maybe 30 or 40% heavier than that before they den up in November. So maybe up around 600, 650 at that time, average, say. But and males will probably be substantially larger, probably 33 to 50% larger.
And do all Kodiak bears look the same, or do they have different colors, and are they different in any way?
Yeah, I think it's hard for people to recognize at first, but they probably just have just as much variation in how they look that we have. The parts that we can recognize is, you know, you see some bears have boxier features, and some are blonde, some are brown. And there's certainly bears that we recognize as really, really pretty, other ones that aren't quite as pretty. But yeah, there's a ton of variation among individuals.
And how much do bears eat?
Well, they eat an enormous amount. You know, they have a unique life history in that they hibernate for a chunk of the year. So they have to eat all of their food in a much shorter period of time than other animals that don't hibernate. So they have the capacity to consume huge amounts of food in short periods of time. Bill, do you remember how many kilograms of salmon the males were consuming in your previous study?
Oh, my goodness. In a study that we did in cooperation with ADFNG and Washington State University, I think,
I think it was 6,000 kilograms?
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah, so one.
Up to that.
Yeah.
For the large males.
A lot of salmon.
And what else naturally goes into their diet? I'm not talking about litter, which can get into their diets around town, but what they would gather in the more rural areas.
Well, you know, bears are omnivores. They can consume a huge variety of foods, and they do in the different populations around the world. Here in Kodiak, the main sources of food are vegetation. Salmon is the biggest source, and then also different species of berries.
Okay, and I've always wondered as I walk through Abercrombie and I see all these bushes, these salmonberry bushes. There are these tiny berries. How much of those do bears need to eat to become full, or how much would they eat per day?
Well, it's hard to give you a number about how much they eat, but you know, there's good research talking about the way that bears eat berries to make a living, and you know, the arrangement of berries on a plant is very important for that. So some of the research showed that a dispersed berry, like a salmon berry, it's very difficult for a large bear to make a living eating a berry like that, because they just can't forage that efficiently. They have to eat it. Even if they eat as fast as they possibly can, they're not consuming many berries. But you can think of other berry species like elderberry, red elderberry, which is a common berry here on Kodiak. It's in a big, huge clump, and so they can consume many berries with a single bite, and so their foraging is much more efficient. So, you know, some of our research showed that they're probably more dependent on species like elderberry, and one of the reasons is because of that foraging efficiency.
Okay. And so salmon is very important to the bear diet in particular?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Bill's previous study showed that, you know, most of the bears that they were studying were males, but there are also many females. And the vast majority of bears in that study on Kodiak Island were consuming more than 50% of their diet consisted of salmon for almost all the bears. So
it doesn't matter what kind of salmon, like pink or red or...
We see some evidence for some preferences, perhaps this is us putting our human perceptions on bears, but it seems like they prefer the same species that we prefer. When they have a choice, it seems like they're choosing sockeye over pinks. Bill has seen bears flocking down towards Chinook salmon when they're available in certain places. But at least in our study area, which is in southwest Kodiak, they really tend to key in mostly on sockeye, and that's because those are the salmon that tend to spawn in the really shallow areas where bears can get them. So there could be a million pink salmon spawning in Carlick River, but if the river's too deep for the bears to access those salmon, then you know they might as well not exist. Where in contrast, sockeye salmon are spawning in very shallow streams, and so they can efficiently fish for them.
In other places on the island, though, sockeye may not be as available. So in Dead Man, for example, it's mainly pinks that are available. And in some other places in New Yak, it's mainly pinks. So they're focusing on what's available. So it depends on what's available also.
Okay. And so what kind of condition do they want the fish to be in? Do they want them to be flailing and strong? Do they want them to be weak and young, or young and old? Or do they need to have spawned already or not spawned? Or what's the best fish?
Well, you know, bears will choose the best thing that's available at any given time. So we see their preferences change. So if they can, they're going to go after the fish the fish that have most recently come out of the ocean. We did a study a few years ago where we monitored the fat in different salmon using a pretty fancy tool called the fish fat meter. And we find that as they come out of the ocean, sockeye can have 15% fat. And then only a month later, once they enter streams, they are down to 1% fat. So, of course, a bear, if they can, will grab that 15% fat salmon. But then later in the season, once the salmon are done spawning, they're down to just eating carcasses. So they do make these choices, but it's limited by the choices that they're given at any given time.
And they're not damaged at all by spawned fish?
Doesn't seem like it. No, we see them eating spawned out fish. Bill, what do you think about that?
No, there's no evidence of that. And indeed, you'll see some bears that really focus on, some of the largest bears that I've seen, focusing on carcasses, where they'll go and where the fish have been washed down into the lake from these spawning streams. They'll go around, they'll walk around and kick the fish up and pick them up. They've been dead for quite a while, and they'll just gobble them right down.
Do bears have very strong stomachs? They go after carcasses of different animals?
It seems like, yeah, they have very strong stomachs. They don't seem to be bothered by eating rotten stuff. You know, I think that a lot of the bears have lots of parasites, but we don't see any really distinct costs of that. So yeah, much stronger stomachs than we have.
So could you guys talk again about some of the studies you've been working on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for my dissertation work, which I just finished, there were a few specific focuses, and one of them was about bear movements around the island in response to different timing of sockeye spawning. And the cool thing that we found is that bears are really good at moving from place to place to eat salmon. And this is really important because each individual spawning population might only be spawning for 2 or 3 weeks. So it's a very brief time. And if that was the only, if they only ate salmon at that one spot, their salmon consumption would be very low. But by stringing together multiple sites where each population is providing salmon for 3 weeks at a time, they can consume salmon for much longer, like 3 months. And we think that this behavior is critical to their being able to consume enough salmon to make the living that they make here and become, you know, large Kodiak bears.
Okay. And so how did you gather that information about these bears? How did you track them?
Oh, there's a number of different ways that we did it. For number one, in the spring, we would capture bears and fit them with GPS radio collars so that we could track their movements. And that was a small, we had 40 bears over the period of this study, 40 bears that were radio collared and that we tracked over a number of years. Another way that we did it was we put up bear cams, or what we call remote wildlife cameras, on the suite of streams that we're working on, 12 different streams across Karluk Basin, Red Lake Basin, and Fraser Basins. And we had them in specific places each of the years, and we would have, when we programmed them to take one photograph every 5 minutes. Okay, and this was enabled us to get an index of use of those streams by the bears. That's one way. And then we also, and Will can talk about this in more detail, we needed to quantify the salmon runs in these 12 different streams, both in abundance and timing, in order to get at some of these questions, to answer some of these questions. And we did that with a paired video camera, remote camera, still camera system, in which we had panels along the bed of the stream, white panels, and we'd be taking 3 photos every minute, and that would be paired with some video cameras in order to quantify the salmon runs and their timing. And Will can give you more details on that.
Yeah, so we used those data from the salmon counting systems, and then some aerial observations and also weir observations, and that gave us a good idea of when the salmon were available at different times on the landscape. So then we can use the movements from the collared bears to see whether or not they're using those different, you know, how many different salmon populations they're using and in what order. And that shows us that they're, so there's a type of literature about this in other animals called resource waves. And when we see an animal using a resource wave, the lingo is to say that they're surfing the resource wave. So in this case, bears are surfing the salmon wave, going from the early spots to the middle spots into the later spots. And they do this with, you know, great skill, and the data shows that really nicely.
When did you begin this study?
Well, the idea came out of, I said this towards the beginning, the idea came in 2010 because we saw this large decline in bears, and it took a couple of years to get things off the ground. We started fieldwork in 2012, and so we've gone 2012 through last year, 2015. That was our last year of data collection.
Have you noticed any trends from 1 year to the next, or was it consistent?
What we saw is that salmon runs tended to increase throughout that period, in at least our study system. And we also saw big differences among years in weather. So the last 2 years in particular were very, very warm, and that changed the vegetation community for the bears. And the key thing that it did is that it made phenology much earlier. So phenology is talking about the timing of vegetation when it becomes, you know, when fruits become ripe, when flowering occurs. And so that tends to become earlier in warmer weather. So the last 2 years we saw very early flowering and very early fruiting. And so we saw an unusual event where in normally salmon runs and berries are available at two different times. And this last 2 years, they occurred at the same time, overlapping in time.
And so you would go out to these different locations for what period of time?
Well, we had these camera systems that Bill was talking about doing the data collection for us. So all these camera systems were out and we would go visit them every week or two. And that's important because, you know, when people are on landscapes, they change the behavior of bears because a lot of bears are afraid of people. So we focused very closely on having methods that didn't change where bears were and what kind of foods they were eating.
Yeah. How did you do that?
Well, we had these remote camera systems monitoring the salmon runs. We had remote camera systems monitoring bear use along streams. And then we also used aerial surveys of bear use. So those things are lower impact on bears as opposed to us walking out all the time and, say, counting the number of salmon that are in streams directly or walking along and counting the number of bears that are on the streams.
For example, in the Wood River system, they didn't employ these systems. So they were going out and walking these streams almost daily to count salmon abundance, numbers of bears, or evidence of bears utilizing salmon. So the methods that we employed, we attempted to minimize adverse impact on bears, okay? Because that would bias our study also, or the results of our study.
Yeah, and I've heard that bears can hear you from miles away.
Yeah, they have pretty good hearing and vision, very similar to ours. But the thing that they excel at is this excellent sense of smell. And so, you know, we could be pulling them up in a boat and be clearing bears out of an area, you know, miles away without realizing it, just because our scent is being spread across the landscape. So even if you don't see bears, oftentimes we're having an impact that we don't realize.
And could you remind me of what locations you focused on?
Yeah, we focused on three river lake basins, Carluck Lake, Carluck River, Fraser Lake, Dog Salmon River, and Red Lake area. And we had 12 different streams. Will, if you want to go ahead and say which streams we're working on.
Well, we saw, you know, most of our streams were on Carluck. There are eight on Carluck and then a couple on Red Lake. But this network of rivers and lakes makes up what we call the Southwest Kodiak, Alaska. So it's the western half of Kodiak Refuge.
How did you choose that area?
Well, this is, you know, there's been lots of work done in Carluck. It's one of the most studied salmon and bear systems. And that's the spot where that's the spot where these surveys that the Fish and Wildlife Service does show that there is this bear decline. So it made sense for us to focus our study on this place where we saw impacts to the bear population.
Yeah, so in 2012, ADF&G and the refuge conducted one of these surveys in the Carluck Basin, saw a decline. We wanted to make sure that the decline was real, so we did that again in 2013, and indeed, we got the same results. So it indicated a decline for some reason in the Carluck Basin, and along with some other surveys, the aerial surveys that we do, we saw lower proportions of what we call family groups, so lower numbers of cubs, okay, with sows. And so this information kind of initiated the investigation in some ways.
And so based on the information you've gathered so far, what are some of the reasons for the declines in your estimation?
Well, you know, it's always difficult to reconstruct exactly what happened in the past, but we have some good evidence from the studies that we've done that early run sockeye, so sockeye that are spawning in streams, and that early run sockeye are a very important resource, and then also that these elderberry are a very important resource. In fact, they're probably the preferred resource on the landscape. These bears show behaviors that suggest that they prefer them over salmon. And what we saw is that the 2 years preceding the decline documented in 2010, we had very, very low early sockeye escapement in the Carluck Basin, so less than 50,000, and which is about a tenth of what had occurred in the high just 5 years before. And then we also had two very cold, wet years, which tend to produce really low berry productivity. So it seemed like it was a 1-2 punch of poor salmon returns and then poor berry productivity. If only one or the other had occurred, we maybe wouldn't have gotten the decline that we saw. But because both occurred, they just had no great resources on the landscape those 2 years.
Is there a reason for the decline in fish?
Well, it's very difficult to say because, salmon runs are, salmon populations are very complex. There's lots of different life stages where effects can occur. And so it's fairly normal for natural populations of salmon to vary, by 10 times across time. And so it's difficult to say, but it might've been a combination of, poor management in the past, harvest, maybe some ecosystem effects. So maybe poor productivity in the lakes over a few years. But it really, ecology is extremely complex. And so everybody has their theory, but it's difficult to say for certain what exactly happened.
Do you have any data on areas surrounding Kodiak in the archipelago?
You mean bear abundance data?
Yeah, anything about the fish or the berries and lands, not just on the island, but in the areas surrounding.
We think that the berry productivity is fairly consistent across the area. Salmon runs in the southwest Kodiak tend to be synchronous. So when we see low years in the Karluk Basin, they tend to be low in Red Lake and Fraser. It doesn't seem like the bear populations have declined in other parts of the island like they did in the Karluk Basin and probably the rest of Southwest. So that's good news. This isn't an island-wide phenomena. It seems like the Karluk bears were particularly affected.
And indeed, it may be temporary, okay? It may be not some fluctuation that's going on. For example, most recently, in the last 2 years, for example, we've had excellent berry crops and really high salmon runs. And in concurrent with that, we've also seen larger numbers of cubs on the landscape, okay, in the last 2 years. It's really spiked when it was really, really low the previous years.
Okay, so do you have some predictions for maybe next year, the coming years, maybe like thinking of 5-year chunks?
Well, there could be some interesting effects. If we have a chunk of years starting in 2000, probably 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, which with very low cub productivity. And so that's going to propagate through the population. So we'll have a period of time with few young adults. But at the same time, now we're getting a ton of cubs. And so soon there's going to be a whole bunch of subadults on the landscape. The interesting thing will be in another 5 or 7 years to see whether or not there's a reduction in the number of large males on the landscape. And those are the ones that are that hunters focus on. Those are the ones that they want to take. So that could occur just because we see a lag effect of this very low productivity period in 2008, 2009, 2010.
Have you been in contact with bear biologists doing similar studies in other parts of Alaska?
Well, actually, yeah, we just came from a conference in Anchorage, which is focused on bears. There's bear biologists from all over the world. And there's awesome work going on all over Alaska. It's a hot spot for bear research.
And just note that we also work very closely with ADF&G here in Kodiak with the wildlife biologists. Okay, so a lot of this work was always done in cooperation with them. For example, the intensive aerial surveys where we, in 2010 and 2013, that was a joint effort. And then not enough can be said about the job that the fisheries biologists do at ADF&G in monitoring salmon runs at the weirs. Excellent work.
Can you give us a little update on how bears in other parts of the state are doing with some of the other innovations that are happening out there?
Well, you can... With bears, especially brown bears, you can split the state into two different groups. So we have a lot of the coastal populations where bears are very valued as trophy animals for trophy hunting. Those are all the coastal areas. And then there's interior areas where that is not as much the case. And the pattern in Alaska over the last decade is for at least for those interior bears, to be more and more frequently viewed as competitors with humans for ungulate calves, mostly moose. So interior populations have increasingly been targeted for intensive management to reduce their populations with the idea that it might increase productivity of moose populations. So this is somewhat controversial in the bear community, but that's the pattern, reducing, you know, the focus being reducing interior bear populations.
And here on Kodiak, that really isn't the story, because brown bears are so highly valued here. We don't have caribou, we don't have moose, et cetera. And, in the bear industry, or people that depend on the bear population, is has a strong voice here. So it's a slightly different management situation here than it is on, in interior Alaska.
And there's so much to explore here, considering that there are so many bears and so many different kinds of bears and locations. What studies are you thinking about doing next? What's the next project?
Well, actually, we're continuing further investigations with the questions that we're looking, or questions that we've been looking at the last 4 years, and kind of some ancillary questions. And Will is actually going to be doing a postdoctoral. He's taking up a postdoctoral position at Oregon State University to work on some of these, and Will can say more about that.
Yeah, so one thing we often hear as bear biologists is managers want to know what will happen in the future. And for example, they might say, how will climate change impact bears? What would happen if we change salmon management? How would that affect bears? You know, what will happen if the berry populations crash? And those questions are very difficult to answer with real data from the field, because these are scenarios that haven't happened. And so the plan for my postdoc is to take all of the data that we've collected over time and create, for lack of a better word, a virtual bear. And that way, a virtual bear population that makes decisions about foraging and where to be on the landscape. And that way we can test out different hypotheses for how they'll respond to different impacts. So if climate change, say, changes the timing of salmon runs, we can see how that will affect bear populations. And that way we can greatly increase the utility of the data we've collected and try to explore impacts that are really just thoughts at this point in managers' minds.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Talk of the Rock, and we've been talking about the population of bears on Kodiak and talking to two researchers who have been focusing on that and the decline that happened a couple of years ago. So you can hear the full archived episode on KMXT.org. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us.